in my TEDx talk, and that's where the name The Resilient Kid came from, really, was I said a line about, you know, we should be teaching kids to fail, we should be teaching them to be resilient, things like that. But there's a part in it that I say, you know, if I asked you, Lucy, the Battle of Hastings, you could probably give me what year that was, because we, you know, we were drummed into us at school. And we don't need that now, because, you know, when we were at school, we couldn't just look up on, you know, one of the platforms. We couldn't just go to a search engine. We can do that now and get the same information in kind of 0.5 seconds. Why are we getting the kids to learn by rote? So the big thing for me is let's learn, let's use technology so that we can look up information, but that we learn in a more curious way.
Welcome to the Sleep Nanny podcast. We're here to serve as your parenting partner, your sanity saver, and bring you a healthy dose of wholesome conversation with guests and experts to make the minefield of parenting more joyful and less overwhelming. Hi everyone, and welcome back to the show. So this week I'm honored to be joined by Ashley Costello. She's a psychotherapist, a TEDx speaker, and Ashley teaches all about raising resilient children. So today she's going to be talking to us about future-proofing our kids, something we all need to learn about. Ashley, a massively warm welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lucy, and thanks for inviting me on. I'm really excited about today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So Ashley, to get started, I'd love for you to share with us just a little bit about your journey into this being your profession, all about raising resilient children. Like, how did you get into this?
Yeah, so, excuse me, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think when you talk to a lot of teens, they don't really know what they want to do. And from being about 14, I always wanted to go into psychology. Wasn't really sure what it was. I just knew it was kind of the study of the mind. And I was like, oh, yeah, I quite like the idea of that. It was a bit different, you know. And then when I was 16, my dad had a nervous breakdown. My sister's 10 years younger than me, so she was only six. So she was kind of packed off to my nana's. And my mum was left to pick up the pieces. And it's actually really difficult because there was no support for the family. Like, it was like, yes, he's really struggling here. We'll get him some help. You know, we'll get him medication, whatever. And it was just brought on by stress. It was a complete kind of overload and a chemical imbalance brought on by stress. So it was something that was fixable. It was going to take quite a bit of time. We would have old dad back, you know, eventually. But we were left a little bit like, oh my God, like what has happened? It came completely out of the blue. Now, my sister at that time, because she was at my nana's, she kind of didn't really understand anything. We didn't really share anything with her. But then it happened again, a good few years later. I was 24. I was a psychology graduate. I was a psychotherapist. And I remember the day clear as a bell. I literally said to my mum in the morning, Dad's not well. And she said, oh, thank goodness. And we went to church. Now, my mum was brought up really heavily Catholic. And we were brought up in church schools, but my mum was very around, you know, you ask questions around everything. She was a very curious kind of person. Yeah. So we weren't like really heavily religious, but that day we both felt like this spiritual, we're going to need this. So we both went to church in the morning and we came home and we kind of hankered down because we knew what was coming. And I rang the doctor, I knew who to ring, I knew where we were going to get help, what the next stages were. We sat my sister down, who by this point is 14, so she's a teen, she knows what's going on. And everything was done so smoothly, so easily, and yeah, and he was right in half of the time, like literally half of the time, he was wow, back better. And so it was one of those moments where you think, that's what I did this for. That's why this came to fruition. And yeah, one of the big things for me is as I was training and as I was, you know, looking at different paths to do, I always thought I'm going to be an educational psychologist. Now, A lot of educational psychologists will spend a lot of time in schools, or they'll do a lot of assessments and things like that. And I started to go down that path and I thought, oh, okay, so I'm going to get an hour with this child and that's it. And my job is literally playing with kids most of the day, like not always playing, but, and I just thought, I can't do that because I will not have that face-to-face interaction with kids. And so, so I thought, right, okay, I'm going to do this. And did therapy, kind of trained in therapy, and then specialized in young people. And I was just very, very lucky that I had really, really good experiences here and abroad. We lived abroad for a few years, so I had lots and lots of experience with everyone from 2 right up to 80, to be honest. But wow. You know, I do the majority between kind of primary, secondary and uni students. And yeah, it's been a blessing. They keep me on my toes and I love it. Yeah. It's a really lovely job to have.
I bet. And I imagine as well, it's an ever-evolving thing as we live in an age now with complications, or I suppose additional things to consider with tech that wasn't around, you know, even a decade ago, it wasn't what it is today. And we're raising children in like a whole different world, and it's continually evolving. I'm sure we'll get to that. And I'm sure that's part of the work that you do, is like everything's changing, and the way their minds are developing must be different. I don't know. I'm not the expert, but I'm assuming it must be different than it was.
You're absolutely right. And I'm a massive advocate for technology. And I think we should use it more in schools. You know, a lot of people are crying out and saying less, and I think we should use it more so that it frees us up to learn in a different way, to be more curious. So one of my things, and I think you mentioned it at the beginning, in my TEDx talk, and that's where the name The Resilient Kid came from, really, was I said a line about, you know, we should be teaching kids to fail, we should be teaching them to be resilient, things like that. But there's a part in it that I say, you know, if I asked you, Lucy, the Battle of Hastings, you could probably give me what year that was, because we, you know, we were drummed into us at school. And we don't need that now, because, you know, when we were at school, we couldn't just look up on, you know, one of the platforms. We couldn't just go to a search engine. We can do that now and get the same information in kind of 0.5 seconds. Why are we getting the kids to learn by rote? So the big thing for me is let's use technology so that we can look up information, but that we learn in a more curious way. And really extend that to not just learning about topics, but learning about ourselves, learning about our brain, you know, things like that. So technology for me is, it's a real, I think a lot of the parents that I speak to talk about being held kind of by hostage by tech, whereas it would have to be. You know, and I think the biggest thing, without kind of obviously going down that minefield of tech, I think one of the biggest things, my advice to parents is, when you were growing up, you probably, you know, you might have had a computer, you may have had a mobile phone, but maybe not till later. Children now have grown up with these things. Even if they didn't get a phone till they went to secondary school, the minute they sat on your lap, they had your phone, they had an iPad, you know, they had access to laptops, all that kind of thing. And actually, we need to teach them to be responsible. And I think I get a lot of parents, especially teen parents, who will say to me, yeah, but they're in high school now, how can I take the phone off them? Well, it's not their phone. Unless they're paying for it, it's not their phone, it's your phone. And I have a very understanding with mine, where I'll say to them, I've noticed your screen time. What can we do about it? And they'll go, I'm sorry, right, I'll get it back down. You know, things like that. So it's about teaching children responsibility for an item that they don't know the world without. We do.
That's really valid. Like, I love the way you've put that so eloquently and simply, really. It's not there. I've just realised I've just gained 2 iPhone 15s. Brilliant. But yeah, it's so true that we're almost gifting them with these assets that they can use to their advantage, to their great advantage. But with that comes great responsibility. And I think that's really a worthwhile thing to think about with parents who are wondering. I have parents all the time asking, oh, I don't know when to let them have a phone, and they're reluctant, but they know they're going to have to. And it's like, well, actually, maybe the answer is when they are of an age and a maturity that they can be responsible for not only looking after it because they're expensive devices, but also for managing the usage on that. So that's a really I really like how simply you've put that.
Well, if somebody had said to me, here's a gadget that is worth nowadays £700 minimum.
Yeah.
Here's a gadget worth £700, and I'm going to pay for your usage of that every month. But actually, what I'm going to ask you to do is I want you to not scroll, right? And I want to limit certain apps until you're a certain age. And actually, you know, when you get in bed at night, there is no scrolling. You're not allowed to do that. But do you want it or don't you? And the answer is, of course I do. Yeah. Okay, so these are the consequences. This is what happens. Now, I very rarely have to take the phone off my children, but I think you've picked up a really valid point there, Lucy, about when they are old enough to be responsible. So I'll give you an example. My youngest is 14 now, and I never let him have. So he got his first console. He had a Switch, but he never had a PlayStation or any of them until he was 13. And it was a complete surprise. I didn't think he was getting one, because we'd always said, you know, no, you're not having one. You've got a Switch, you've got a phone, you don't need anything else. And it was because we knew in our head, when we gauged that he'd be responsible enough, we'd get him one.
Yeah.
So for his 13th birthday, this is what he's got. And then he says, oh, can I have Fortnite? And I went, no. And he was like, oh, why? So I just literally went, ABC, no. And in summer last year, he came up with this whole PowerPoint presentation of the pros, the cons, and what he could do about the cons. And I said, okay. And it was stuff like, you're going to use it too much. You're going to be drawn into the game. It's about fighting, blah, blah, blah. And he gave me counterpoints to every single argument I had. And so I sat there, and part of me thought, wow, I really admire you. You are now a responsible young guy. You've thought about this. You've put time and effort into it. I admire that. And the other part of me thought, damn, I'm going to have to give in. And I did. You know, I said, do this for your dad. Let's see what he says. I don't want to be the only one making this. And we both agreed, and he got it. And there is times when, you know, we might have to say, okay, mate, it's time. And he'll go, right, okay. Because he knows that it is a responsibility. And if he takes that seriously, then he won't have that game. That's a choice he makes. So, I think it is about them understanding the consequences of using too much tech.
Actually, him putting that in a presentation with these counter arguments, which is brilliant, by the way, and he's used tech for good in doing that, but he's obviously then thought about those negatives, and even just to come up with a counter argument for it still takes the consideration. He's got to digest that, to some extent that in itself is a demonstration of his understanding of the harm that these things can do. Fortnite is a battle in my home. My eldest is 13 and a half, so I can relate. And I imagine you're well aware of the psychotherapist expertise of how they make those things so more. Like if you come out, you're going to be letting your friends down. On if you there's just always another thing or another event or another thing that in somehow where you can earn money or rankings, and it's to keep you going, like an addiction. And
it absolutely is, Lucy. I cannot, without this being, this whole talk being about tech.
Yeah, because it could be.
Yeah, it totally could be. If we look at, I mean, I have got nothing but admiration for the likes of these software developers, like Instagram, like, you know, the games like Fortnite, because they have not just gone, let's make it shiny, let's make it this. They've gone away to neuroscience. They've looked at the what draws people back. Now, the whole thing of these and why they've exploded so much really is because of COVID. But the what draws us together as human beings is connection. And if you, you know, that's why people die of loneliness. And so if you think we're going to ask you to buy this game, and Fortnite are very clever because they don't even actually buy the game, do they? No. But, you know, we're going to ask you to do this. Then we're going to ask you to connect to your buddy. So you're already marketing for them. And then what we're going to do is we're going to award you with various different events or rankings or things. So you've already got that. And then we're going to throw celebrities in the mix. Now, these celebrities usually just lend their brand. They don't even, they're not even involved in it. You know, so you can see, and that's like touching celebrity, isn't it? So how amazing is that? You know, you've got Instagram. And what they do is, so say you posted up today and you put a post on and you got 100 likes. Instagram hold back like 80 likes. So you see 20 and you think, oh, I thought it'd be more popular than that. And then they let a few trickle through, because then you'll check it again and you'll check it again and you'll check it again. So it's very addictive, very, very clever the way they do it. And that's why we've got to teach our kids responsibility.
That's so true. I had no idea.
Teach them about the future. You know, we've got to teach them about tech, not just say, ban it, not just say, well, they shouldn't have it. We've got to teach them that this is how they operate. This is how it works. Go into that open knowing, you know, makes a whole difference, I think.
It's not going away, is it? It's something we have to get comfortable with and work with, not against. And that's, I've always said that. And it's not easy. And lots of parents will be listening to this who, you know, are navigating, well, tech being part of it, but for the first time in a no parent has gone before us and done this, you know, we're the first generation. And so it's not easy. And I think, you know, coming back to raising resilient children, future-proofing them, your whole expertise is built on this. Tell us a bit about, you know, the foundations of that, the foundations of raising resilient children.
So it's really funny, because you hear, especially in our circles, you know, in entrepreneurial circles, we hear resilience all the time. And to the point that I'm bored of it, and I'm, you know, my company's called The Resilient Kid. And actually, so I started, because I'm just franchising at the moment, we're getting ready to launch our franchise, and I thought, actually, how do I deliver this program to other people who, you know, care about kids, who want to be kid champions? How do I do that? And actually, I said, what is resilience? Well, it's future-proofing our kids. Of course it is. And I think a lot of people think that is those children who've been through adversity, you know. And when I say kids, I mean from 3 to 23, you know, literally the whole thing. And what we think is they've gone through trauma or adversity or a hard time, and they've come through the other side and they've pulled the socks up and they've got on with it, and that's resilience. And actually it's not. Resilience can be built, and there's components in resilience that mean that we can build it ahead of that adversity, that life challenge, that trauma that they may struggle with as they grow up. And so looking at things like community, where is their community around them? Who have they got in their community? And that's one of the things that I first look at with any child. Doesn't matter if they're at university, you know, I have quite a few people, uni students who used to live in Abu Dhabi, but come to university here. And so they haven't got their mom and dad and siblings all around them. So who's your community now? Oh, well, I've got my flatmate. Who else? You know, because we need more. We are human beings who need connection. So I always look at community. We look at what kind of connections they've got and who are their safe people to go to. And that doesn't matter if it's in school, that doesn't matter if they have karate after class. You know, have they got people there that they can talk to? You know, not just talk to, but they know that if they were in trouble, that that's their go-to person in that situation. So things like that, that I think you know, as we look at all the components, how does that stack up for our child? And actually, one of them is around, you know, kind of going back to tech. What I've noticed is that we've got more children inside rather than outside. And because they're not getting that exercise or they're not getting that fresh air, their self-care component of resilience is starting to drop. And again, it's up to us as parents to teach them about that. We know we shouldn't stay up and do an extra Netflix if we've got a busy day the next day. We know that, you know, we need to move our bodies a couple of times a week at least. We know that getting outside makes us feel better mentally. We need to teach that. We need to teach that. It's not enough. School can't do that. You know, so it's things like that that we can really help build. And I put together like a little free quiz where people can go and just check out, and they just answer simple questions about their child, and it gives you a little score. But what it does is tell you which of the components that your child is kind of lower in. And the lower your resilience, the lower your mental health, the lower your physical immunity is. So, you know, if I said to you, okay, you do this, 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 and this, and your child be resilient, why would you not?
Definitely. Yeah. And I suppose when all throughout parenthood, you know, the smaller our children are, the more we do for them and with them. And gradually we let go until they can do it by themselves. And I suppose it's all part of that. Like, they're going to learn through doing and observing until they adopt it as important enough to do without you telling them to. So something like getting outside, like you say, the benefits of that are so huge. And again, pandemic didn't help, really. We all felt very much hunkered down for a period of time. It was a very unusual time. But yeah, it can sometimes be easier to stay in and do the easy things. But I suppose there comes a point when a child reaches that age and stage where they're like, no, I want to do this for me because I know how good it feels when I do. And they're only gonna even get that good feeling if we show them, demonstrate that, take them outside, do things with them until, like holding the bike up until they can do it without the stabilizers kind of scenario.
I think that's really interesting what you say there, Lucy, because I think sometimes when we're talking about teaching our children things, what we don't realize is they don't get on a bike after the first time and just ride. You know, how many times have you told your children to brush their teeth? If you had a pound for every time you told a child to brush their teeth, my God, none of us need to work. You know, and that's the thing, is it's not about. And I think sometimes what happens, particularly with tech, but particularly with things like that, like getting out and getting fresh air, sometimes it becomes a path of least resistance. And actually, what we're doing is robbing our kids of the opportunity to learn and the opportunity to future-proof, you know. So things like, for me, responsibility, teaching your child to be responsible. And I don't mean for siblings. Pets are a really good example of that. Chores are a really good example of that. And I have a bit of a bugbear, and I want it when I have so the kind of way I work, I'll do, say, four sessions with a child. I'll chat to the teacher, I'll chat to the bus driver if I need to, whoever's involved with that child, but I'll have a parent session, which I work, my model is very different than, say, the usual therapists, because they don't often work with parents as well. They might do family therapy, but they don't do kind of sessions with the children and then parent sessions. Yeah. And as a parent myself, I think it's really important that they get support. So I don't share what the children say in the session. That is still kept confidential. But what I will do is I'll say, what are you seeing at home? What are you struggling with? Okay. And then I'll give them tips, you know, so working to give the children strategies or the student strategies, but then also the parents separately, because I think that's really important. Because sometimes, you know, well, I always say, if you've got a manual with your first child, you'd have to put it in the bin for your second, you know, because they're all different. So it's about working with the child and the parents where they're at. So one of the first things I always ask is, do your children do jobs around the house? And they'll go, oh, that's a really unusual question. And I'll say, is it? Why? And they go, oh, well, you know, sometimes they might wash up, or sometimes they might, you know, make the bed or whatever. Now, I could give you a long list of chores that my kids can do. And that is because from very young, I have always instilled it in them that this is our house, we all help. Mm-hmm. And it isn't because I think, oh, they can change that bed, I don't need to, although it is lovely now they're older and they can do that. And it's more around because psychologically, when we say we need you to, so I need you to set the table, I need you to tidy your room, I need you to do this, they are needed, they are wanted, there's a place around this table, you belong. That's what we're saying. When they help out, they belong. They're not a visitor. You know, if you came to my house, I wouldn't expect you to lift a finger. Somebody who lives here, who belongs here, helps out. And there's a psychological thing about taking that responsibility for that child, and they take responsibility for being part of a family and a team and, you know, whatever else you want to call it. And those who do get on better at university if they go to university. They work better in a team at work. It's been shown through research. But also as well, I find they get on better with friendships and certainly future relationships, because there's no expectation of you do this, you do that. It's what do I need to do? You know, that's the first question. So it not only helps build resilience, but it helps them to feel they belong.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like the framing of that. I know sometimes my children will feel like, well, why do I have to do it when you're stood right there? Or why do, like, they'll do it to my husband. They'll say, like, dad's just sitting there and I've got to go and do this and this yet before school, but he's free. So what? And my husband's brilliant. He's very good at sticking to his guns. I can be a soft touch, but he'll be like, well, because that's your role, because that's your job, and you need to manage your time in order to make sure you can fit your things in. Just because I'm free doesn't mean I have to bail you out on your responsibility. So, and he's right. I just sometimes end up going, oh my God, we're in a rush. Just, but yeah. That doesn't help though, does it? Because if I swoop in and then do the thing for them, then I'm, like you say, actually I'm robbing them of learning those responsibilities, learning time management, and even like, I love that sense of belonging, sense of value. Like, you're valued in this home, and this is your part.
And can I just say, there's two things there that you've brought up. I think it's really good. Well done, Dad, by the way, for that. That sense of belonging for me, and it kind of really touches a nerve when I think about this. And this is the reason. I work with a lot of teens, and some of them can be very troubled, you know. And you, I mean, when I worked in Abu Dhabi, the affluence, I termed a phrase, I did some research on it, and I termed a phrase called affluent neglect. So these kids did not want for anything. However, they didn't have that connection. They never had to lift a finger because there was lots of, you know, maids and nannies around and things like that. And if they forgot the, you know, PE kit, a driver would turn up at the school with it and things. So there isn't that sense of connection. There isn't that sense of belonging. And what happens with teens when they don't feel they belong, they look for it elsewhere. So where else? And you feel that you belong. Well, if somebody's offering you drugs, or somebody's offering you alcohol, or somebody's offering, you do this for me and we've got your back, why would you not? If you have not got that at home, they're going to look elsewhere. And that's the biggest thing. And it's heartbreaking, because actually you think it's not that hard a thing to instill in your kids. And actually, I think it's because we don't want to think that they have to do the cleaning or they have to tidy up after themselves. We don't, you know, we want them to have a happy, easy life. And a lot of my parents will say, and they'll go, oh, but I don't want the argument, or I don't want the battle. And I'll go, yeah, but that's because when they say no, you're giving in. If they know no is no, you don't have a battle as much. Mm-hmm. As if, you know, one thing that I always think about is around kind of this kind of thing. I always say to my parents, do you want your kids happy? And they'll go, yeah. I'll go, or do you want them safe? And they'll be like, oh, hold on a minute. What do you mean? I can't have both. I say, you can't have both all the time. No, you can have safety all the time. You can't have happy and safe. And I think that's sometimes when we try and be friends with our kids.
Yeah.
We let them away with, I don't like we're away. I don't even mean that. I mean, just we go, okay, you don't need to do it. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, my daughter has got exams this week. She hasn't, you know, she hasn't made tea. She hasn't emptied the dishwasher. Her brother is moaning. And I'm like, mate, she's got exams. When it's your turn, you don't do anything, you know? So there is a flexibility around it. But I think sometimes as parents, we always want our kids to be happy. And actually, I want mine safe. I'd love for them to be happy and safe all the time. It's not always possible because there's going to be times when they want to go to a concert in Liverpool on the train on a Saturday night. I'm going to go, absolutely not.
Not happening.
That is just not happening, girl. You know,
and
so
you can be unhappy about it, but it's, I have those kinds of decisions at the moment. And
my job is to keep you safe. It's not to make you happy. It is to keep you safe. Now, don't get me wrong. That is a real life situation I've just described with my daughter. And what I said to her was, she's in sixth form, she's only 16, but she's, you know, year 12, and she wanted to go to Liverpool to this concert with friends, and they were coming home on the train. And I said, if I could pick you up, I don't mind you going on the train because it's early. I said, but I'm not having you come home on the last train from Liverpool. So she, going around the houses, wasn't happy at all. I said to her, is he on any other time, this guy you want to go and see in concert? Yeah, he's on the night before in Manchester. Go there. I can pick you up from there. I just couldn't do it that night. I just couldn't do it that night. None of us were available. So the answer's no. And she sulked. And I let her sulk for the day. Like I wasn't, you know, whatever, get on. And I said to her the next day, enough now. And she said, what do you mean? I said, you're sulking. And I get it. And I get that you're disappointed. And I'm disappointed for you. I wish I could say to you, go, have a lovely time. I said, I've given you an alternative. If you don't want to take that, that's your choice. It's not my job to keep you happy. It's my job to keep you safe.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love it. Yeah, it's not easy. Well, it can be easy. That's the thing. It can be easy. We don't make it easy on ourselves. And we put all this additional meaning. I think that's the problem. I know I do. And I give it meaning. And like you said, the flexibility, she has exams, you've gone out, do you know what? She's got things on her mind this week. And I think that's really lovely if you've got the norm, but then you can have that flexibility. Because then that also does demonstrate, like, I've got your back. And then, you know, hopefully they learn to do that too, so we can do things for each other out of kindness, and that they also learn acts of kindness and that sort of thing, but that with the responsibility there too, it's it is so important.
It is. And I talk a lot with families, so sometimes I'll have the whole family around the table and we'll do a family meeting and really air what's going on and how we can solve it and stuff. And one of the things I talk about is the family pot. And it's like, okay, so dad earns. So, you know, traditionally, dad earns, he's put money in the pot. And, you know, mum probably working as well. So she's putting money in the pot. But mum's also doing like the washing and the ironing and blah, blah, blah. And who's cooking dinner? And also, mum's also there when you come home from school and you've had a crappy day. Or she's there when you've had a falling out with your friends. Or, you know, anything like that, or you broke up with a girlfriend or a boyfriend or whatever. So, okay, so let's have a look. Who's financially putting in the pot? Who's practically putting in the pot by helping out? And who's emotionally putting in the pot? And then have a look. Who wants to take out of this pot? All of you want to take out? Of course we do. Of course we do. So, for instance, if you've got a child that, say, does a lot of extracurricular and they need lots of lifts. Okay, well, what are you putting in the pot for that? What? And you see their face and they're like, just because this has always happened doesn't mean, say, it always will. You need to put something back that means, so for instance, if it was mine goes to acting, one of mine goes to acting school twice a week. It's a bit of a journey and will happily do it. However, I'm going to spend 2 hours in the car. So what are you putting in for that? Now, I don't time it. I don't go, I've spent 2 hours in the car for you. Of course I don't. But what I do is, what are you doing to help around the house? Which means frees me up so I can come. I can take things like, don't just go to bed without saying goodnight to me. You know, because A, that's what we expect as a family. But also that's emotionally putting in the pot. Night, mum. Love you. See you in the morning. Awesome.
Yeah. That's so it's important to me as well.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I really like that. Like, I think if we all drew a metaphorical pot, we'd be quite amazed at how much imbalance there is quite often in families.
Absolutely. And it was funny because I did it on my podcast. I explained the scenario, and then I had mum contact me and say, Ashley, I've done this, and this is the pot that my youngest, who's in high school, this is how it's worked. And I was like, amazed, come on the podcast, tell me all about it. And she did. And I said, how has it worked for you, and has there been any unseen benefits? And she said, honestly, she said, the boys just get it now. They get that I'm not just moaning. She said, so that's really good. She said, but the most valuable unseen benefit is that now my husband has to do more, because he suddenly realized he's financially probably the biggest pot
contributor. Yeah.
He contributes the most that way. But actually, what he's realized is he sat while everybody's running around after dinner and stuff. And so he's now started to get involved. And she went, thank you. I was like, I didn't do anything. You did it. So, yeah. So stuff like that, it can have really, you know, valuable side effects you weren't expecting.
Yeah. I can imagine, though, it being a good family exercise to do. You should do like a big template and have stickers that people can put in, and they can go, right, let's assess our family pot. How is it going? Yeah, I love that. Really like that concept. Amazing stuff. So when it comes to, people will be listening to this with really little ones, like babies, and thinking ahead. I know you and I have got teenagers, and I've got a preteen and a teen, and sort of partway there, but there's still another level to go to. There always is. But future, you know, the future is the future. We all know that lots of things from childhood come out in our 30s and our 40s and so on. So teaching our children, thinking about future-proofing them, so teaching them responsibility is a massive one. Not depriving them of the opportunity to demonstrate their value, their belonging, and developing skills for the future as well. Anything else that you feel is a must know when it comes to future-proofing them?
I think particularly for new parents, but when you have got little ones, the biggest thing for me to start it off is, yes, have those connections around you, but more importantly, don't do stuff for them. Allow them to make mistakes. So for instance, when they're really tiny, we can't wait for their first word. We can't wait for them to walk. Would we walk for them instead of watching that first step? Absolutely not. We would not. Why would you take the joy out of that? You know, it's a beautiful phase, isn't it? As they start to toddle around the furniture and things like that. And so that's a little bit like, as they get older, and yes, okay, sometimes we're in a rush and we have to help out or whatever. But the biggest thing for me I see with little ones is when we start to take over, we do things for them because we don't want them hurt. We don't want them unhappy. And actually, we're not teaching them that we can do hard things or they can do hard things. As a human race, our brains are wired to do hard things. So allow them to make mistakes, allow them to fall over, allow them to, you know, get dressed and put the 2 feet in one leg of a trouser or something like that, you know, and then help them correct it, you know, but help them correct it rather than us rushing in and doing everything for them. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's easy, isn't it, to think about it as a, like just dressing themselves or just brushing their own teeth or things like that. It doesn't have to be perfect. But what it teaches them is confidence. It gives them confidence that they can try and they can get it wrong and they can try again. And actually, sometimes we swoop in and we do it for them because we don't want them to get it wrong or we don't want them upset. And actually, we're taking away the opportunity for them to build their confidence and obviously then their resilience. But, you know, that giving them, helping them build their brave, that's how I talk about it when they're younger.
Yeah.
Really give them an opportunity to help them build their brave. We're then not going to end up with, you know, worried or anxious children. They're going to want to do things away from you because they know they can, because you've given that cornerstone. And that is, that in its essence is the cornerstone of resilience. So
that's just beautiful. Do you know that I love the way you've talked about this in general. And then I'm thinking, like, my brain is going, this is exactly what we say when we talk about sleep, because when it, right to, you know, little young babies, when babies need help to get to sleep, you know, it's not something they just know how to do straight away without some sort of support, because they've been in the womb and there've been all these other things that have assisted the onset of sleep. Then you go and put a baby down in a completely still, empty, flat space in a quiet room and they're like, whoa, what's this? And they don't know what to do. So we massively advocate, you know, teaching the healthy development of good sleep. So we don't just put them down and expect them to figure it out or to cry until they nod off. That's not learning, you know, really. That's just kind of disengaging. But that said, we don't do it for them forever. So when we talk to parents with seven-year-olds that are still cuddling up with them in their bed and fiddling with their hair all night long as a comforter, that's a prop for them. And it's because they can't do it by themselves. So they can't go to that sleepover or have that independence because they're relying on something to do it for them. And this is why, you know, if we rock a baby to soothe them, of course we do that. That's instinct. But if we rock them all the way to sleep every single time they stir, or, you know, stick a dummy in or milk in every single time they stir in order to put them to sleep, then we're doing it for them, to, you know, continually doing it for them to the point that they don't actually start to recognize the sensations of falling to sleep in their body and like, oh, okay, this is becoming familiar, and oh, look, I'm safe, I'm loved, I'm responded to, I'm all my needs are met, this is okay. And they can't feel that resilience, that they can't feel that that sense of being okay if we don't give them the space to do that. So it's supporting them whilst they develop those skills. And I, you know, everything you were just saying there about everything, really, I'm like, this relates exactly to sleep as well. And
it does, because I love your stuff. Obviously, before we kind of, you know, got to know each other a little bit, I looked at your stuff. And actually, what I like about the symmetry between our work is it's about building. You know, it's not just going to be there. It's not it's not that, oh, this is it, and here's your magic fix. And I think we think sometimes when parents come to people like ourselves who, you know, and I always say, you're the expert with your kids. This is my expertise. You know, same with you, Lucy. It's around, for me, it's around building that. You know, we, as I said, we can do hard things. As humans, we can do hard things. Sometimes it is about just getting through that hard bit, because parenting is hard. You know, it's the hardest job. I've been doing this 25 years. I've seen thousands and thousands of kids. It's still my kids that push my buttons, you know. But so it is that around building the skills and giving them the opportunity to build, whether it's, you know, learning to fall asleep or self-soothe, you know, or whether it's building confidence or building their brave. I think there's such similarity between it. But I think both of us really kind of passionately believe it. It's a building process. It's not just an overnight thing.
100%. Yeah. Beautiful. Oh, Ashley, thank you so much for coming on the show today, sharing your amazing expertise and your wisdom, your experience. It's so valuable, and I really hope that our listeners, I'm sure they've taken away some real golden nuggets today that they can implement. And that's what I love, is the things that you can take away and implement into daily life, small changes that you'll start to see big results. If there is somebody looking to ask you any questions or they'd like to reach out to you or find out more about you, where can people find you, Ashley? Where's the best place for them to connect with you?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking, Lucy. It's been lovely. It's really pleasure. Lovely to talk to like-minded people and just knowing that there's other people out there that support parents because, you know, it is the hardest job in the world. You can find me on Instagram. I've got a Facebook community as well, a free Facebook, which there's lots of resources in there. Or you can email me at ashley@theresilientkid.co.uk. I'll happily answer any questions or have a little chat, whatever you need.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, we'll put those links all in the show notes as well, so they're nice and handy and accessible for all of our listeners. So, Ashley, once again, thank you so, so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks, Lucy. Take care.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us today. Make sure you hit the follow or subscribe button on your podcast app so that you don't miss a juicy episode. And if you want to find out more about how Sleep Nanny can help you or about becoming a sleep consultant franchisee, head over to the Sleep Nanny website on sleepnanny.co.uk. If you've enjoyed the episode today, please help us spread the goodness and share it with a friend and leave us a podcast review so that more people can benefit from the takeaways that make parenting feel a little lighter. See you for the next episode of the Sleep Nanny podcast.